funny if the room will tell us. I've often heard it quoted that your spouse is supposed to be the other half of your soul. First of all, where do we see that? And second of all, how can we say that in view of the fact that many great people, such as Yunus and Ibn Uzeel, who's become the supporter for marriage, didn't get married?
The makar that your wife is your soulmate, it goes back to Chazal's teaching that man and woman were originally one, and Hashem separated them. And the Gemara describes the process of getting married as finding that which you lost. The Gemara says, why does a man look for a woman? Because when a person loses something, it is the derech of the one who lost something to look for what he lost. The implication would be that I lost the person that I eventually married. Now, how did I lose them? What does that mean? So the interpretation is, because we really were one neshama, and I lost that half. Now, it's interesting, it's only described as the man losing it, as if the woman didn't lose it, in a sense. It's hard to know what that means. If we were one and we're separated, we both lose something. But the man is described as losing it. And the Zohar's Lashon is indeed, a person who is not married is only plag inish, is only half a man. So at least indirectly, it's from the Gemara, basically the idea of man and Adam and Chavra were one and Hashem separated them. In reality, it's a machlokas in the Gemara, though. Keep in mind that there is a machlokas in the Gemara if Hashem created man-woman unit as one, or first created man, then took a woman from man. So this is whole discussion is going like that, man diyomar. How do you understand the idea that there may have been occasionally very, very great gedolim that didn't get married? I don't know. I mean, either we would say that the level of their neshama was so great that they were born with the completion of their neshama, they didn't need it. Or we can say the other way around, as great as they were, right? You can have half a neshama that might be a million times bigger than my whole neshama, right? In other words, the capacity of the neshama was so great that even if there was a pagam, it was still much, much greater than anything we could imagine. So I honestly don't know. People say, although I don't think we know for sure, people say the Ramchal was not married. In fact, that was part of why, you know, the Ramchal was a great, great Kabbalist. He died also young, before the age of 40, like Rabbi Akiva. He's buried next to Rabbi Akiva. And the Ramchal was very persecuted in his lifetime by the Jewish community because he publicly taught Kabbalah, and they didn't want that. This was around the time of Spinoza and the like. So the community of Amsterdam threatened to put the Ramchal in Cheirim unless he stops teaching Kabbalah, and supposedly he burned, or was forced to burn, tens of thousands of pages of Kabbalistic writing. That were simply, and many things were printed, but many, many more times than was printed were the things that were destroyed. And they say that part of their taina on him was that you're not even supposed to learn Kabbalah, and certainly not teach it, if you're not married. So they say that was a thing on the Ramchal himself. Yeah.
So I have to build my question a little bit. So in Makkos on Yadal Amud Beis, there's a machlokas between Yochanan and Rish Lakish about where they learn you can't go into the basement just while you're tamei. And essentially, Rish Lakish learns from a pasuk, and Yochanan learns from a gezeir sheva, and it comes down to that Rish Lakish didn't learn this because they were shoved from his rabbi. And I had a question on that. Like, Rabbi Yochanan's his rabbi. And then in Shabbos, there's a Tosfos that kind of talks on the subject, saying that there's a set number because they are shoved that someone, like, learns that there are. And that this just wasn't, that if one of these their shovers isn't one of them, then they don't accept it. But my question is, how could you not accept, especially at this time, how could you not accept a gezeira shava from someone when there's a masorah going from rabbi to rabbi, going back to Moshe? It's from Moshe, that there's no doubt. How could you just not accept it? It's Torah, it's what it is.
Yeah, that's a very very excellent, good question. First of all, I commend people who are, you know, you're already up to Daf Yudalit. It's good to always do the middle of a Masechta too, not just the beginning. I've always noticed, when from the time I was in Yeshiva, it always struck me that the beginning of every Masechta, every Shas, the beginning, the pages are so well worn when you get to the middle, people don't get there. So, Baruch Hashem, I'm glad you're doing that. Yeah, the statement that's being referenced is the statement of Chazal, that a person cannot make a Gezeirah Shavah on his own unless he accepted it from his Rebbe. And the way that is interpreted is not just from your Rebbe, but there has to be an unbroken Masorah from all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And the reason is, the Rishonim say, because otherwise Gezeirah Shavahs could be abused, unlike other midos that are logical. So logic we can argue with. Gezeirah Shavah, I could take anything. I could take Vayomer, Vayomer, Vayidaber, Vayidaber. I mean, I could take any pairing of words. And as a result, there has to be a Masorah. So the question is, not just that, but many other areas. Well, we often have machloksim in the Gemara. One person makes a Gezeirah Shavah for a certain halacha. Another person either disagrees with the halacha or, in a case like this, agrees with the halacha but does not use the Gezeirah Shavah. And the question is, if every Gezeirah Shavah, by definition, has to be a received halacha l'moshe misinai, then how is it shayach for a man d'omer to say, I don't go with that Gezeirah Shavah? If it would be a logical deduction, which many drushes are, so one could say, my svara is different. But this is not a logic. Gezeirah Shavah is not a logical deduction, it's simply halacha l'moshe misinai. So let me give you maybe two answers. It is a very good question. One answer, number one, is when we say the Gezeirah Shavah is halacha l'moshe misinai, we mean the word pairing is halacha l'moshe misinai, but not necessarily the specific two verses that are supposed to be connected. Meaning, it's as if you were given a sheet of paper, it's kind of a code. Daber, daber, or vayishalchu, vayishalchu, is a Gezeirah Shavah. But which two psukim are being identified is a function of svara and logic, and therefore, even if Reish Lakish differs with Rav Yochanan, behechrech, he doesn't always tell us, he would use the word pairing of some different pasuk for something else, which is not always being discussed. Because Chazal don't always tell you everything. Sometimes a Gemara is like the tip of an iceberg. There may be all sorts of alternative drushes. So that's interpretation number one, that the Kabbalah Meirabo is not referring to the specific two verses that you're linking, it's referring to the word pair that has the validity of a Gezeirah Shavah, and on that there could be a machlokas. I don't think it's that those two psukim that you're dealing with. The second interpretation is a little similar, but a bit different. That is, even if we assume that there's a direct Mesoira, not only on the words, but on the psukim, but the direct Mesoira is that these two words are used for a Gezeirah Shavah, but it doesn't tell you for which law. And Reish Lakish is basically saying it's not for this law. Now, it would have to be for some law. Once again, we're not told what that is. But there is not a direct Mesoira, for example, that I use these psukim for the halacha of a Tamei Shenichnas L'Mikdash. Right, so these are two possible answers. Either way, though, the Gemara is not giving us the entire discussion, because if indeed either the word pair or even the verses are halacha l'moshe misinai, so if Reish Lakish doesn't use it for that law, he would still have to use it for something, and often the Gemara will say, well, what do you use it for? And here the Gemara doesn't do that, so that is a problem. On the other hand, as I say, it's not unparalleled that sometimes, although the Gemara sometimes, it's a good question, I don't have an answer to this, sometimes the Gemara meticulously goes into what alternative will the other person use this verse for. Sometimes the Gemara just drops it and doesn't pursue it. This would be an example of not pursuing it. Another issue is why, meaning if a certain Man D'Amar says, I think the Gezeirah Shavah is for this, and the other Man D'Amar says, I wasn't Makabel. So the way that I'm interpreting it is, he was Makabel, but he's not using it for that. The question is, well, why isn't he using it for that? In other words, what I'm telling you is, and again, it's a dochik in Lashon, that the phrase, I wasn't Makabel, doesn't mean I don't have the Gezeirah Shavah, but I wasn't Makabel that it's used for this. And the question becomes, well, why not? You know, why can't it be used for that? That, too, is something that's not being supplied. Yeah, but it is a very good kasha, yeah.
Hetter Mechira, obviously, it's something that's avoided, I guess, in the Torah community and whatnot.
In the Haredi Torah community.
In the Haredi community, yeah. I should say. And I've heard maybe that well, it should be avoided. It's not as doom and gloom as it maybe made out to be, basically, what's the basic understanding of that?
Okay, well, Hetzer Mechira, very fascinating subject. It would give me an excuse to talk about Drift Cook, but I'm not going to take the full time to talk about Drift Cook in my answer to your question. Hetzer Mechira is not Chazer, certainly, and it's not even Chametz B'Pesach. The issue is this, and in fact, except for the Chazon Ish, the Haredim concede 98% of what the Hetzer Mechira is about. Again, a little bit of history. The Hetzer Mechira, Rav Kook became the chief Rav, not of the State of Israel, there was no state, but he became the chief Rav of Palestine, who was under a British mandate. And Rav Kook was faced with a Jewish community in which there was massive starvation. Unfortunately, the Holocaust overshadowed the tragedies of World War I and before World War I, but so the later Tsarist became even greater than the earlier Tsarist. But you have to remember, if you go back to your history, that there was massive, massive, massive starvation. People were dropping dead in the streets of Yerushalayim out of starvation. It's really a very, very difficult situation. And this is when it wasn't Shemitah. This is when it wasn't Shemitah. And now Shemitah's coming along, and you're not allowed to farm, and imports were not as common as today. So Rav Kook felt it was virtually almost a matter of pikuach nefesh. And therefore, he developed a hetzer based on earlier gedolim, including Rav Yitzchak Ochanan, who was posek hador, that the same idea that by Pesach, that if you sell your chametz to goyim, it's not going to have the laws of Bal Yerah, Bal Yematzeh. So too, if the land is sold to a non-Jew, it is allowed to be farmed even by Jews on Shemitah, because the ownership of a non-Jew takes away the laws of Shemitah. So since then, the Rabbanut has been engaged in what is called the Hetzer Mechira. I have to give Israel credit for this, because you'll notice, even on something like potato chips, you have to be very careful. Have you noticed this? I don't know if you're a potato chip eater, but if you notice it, you will see that there's a big yellow legend on different bags. Some will say Yevol Chutzlaretz, this comes from, and the other will say Hetzer Mechira. Same company. So the companies make two types of products. One is Hetzer Mechira products, and one is Chutzlaretz products. So you have to be careful. If you're in a Haredi neighborhood, almost all the potato chips, I'm an expert on potato chips, the Haredi neighborhood will be Yevol Chutzlaretz, although not all. In more modern neighborhoods, it'll all be totally Hetzer Mechira. So it's the same product with the same Hashgacha. Well, not really, because they obviously, if something normally has the Eidah Haredis, so the Hetzer Mechira will not have the Eidah Haredis, but sometimes it's the same package, so they'll keep it. Okay, now, let me explain that the MS is, in Rav Kook's proposition, there are a number of assumptions. Assumption number one is that once the land is sold to non-Jews, it does not have the holiness of Eretz Yisrael, and it is not subject to the Shemitah law. And that's a controversial proposition. But I want to point out that position is actually held by the Eidah Haredis as well. Because the Eidah Haredis does say you can buy produce of Arabs in Israel and you can use it. That's called Yevul Nachri. So it is only the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was Machmir, that even if it's non-Jewish produce, it has all of the Shemitah laws. We actually don't paskin like the Chazon Ish. We actually paskin that Yevul Nachri does not have the holiness of Shemitah. If that's so, we already concede the basic argument of the Hetzer Mechira. So why are we? I understand why the Chazon Ish is against the Hetzer Mechira, because the Chazon Ish says that even if the land belongs to non-Jews, the laws of Shemitah apply. But when I say we, I mean the bulk of the yeshiva community, we're not Chazon Ishnikers, we don't hold like that. We actually hold, if the land belongs to the non-Jew, the laws of Shemitah doesn't apply. That's exactly what the Eidah Haredis does when it buys stuff from Arab farmers in the Negev. So the big question is, I understand why the Chazon Ish is against Hetzer Mechira. Why are we against Hetzer Mechira? So there are two reasons why we are against Hetzer Mechira. Besides the fact that if the Rabbanut does it, it's got to be no good, which which is not a negligible factor, by the way. They do it? No, I don't care. But the two technical reasons are this, that even if we say that the produce that grows on non-Jewish land doesn't have the prohibitions of Shemitah, so you can eat it without saving the peels and everything else. But that's not a heter to work the land. Meaning to say, Rav Kook used the idea of ownership of the guy to permit Jewish farmers to work the land. That we would not agree with. We say, based on a case of Mishnah, the heter simply says the peros don't have kedusha of Shemitah, but that doesn't permit the working of the land. That's reason number one. Reason number two is, it's one thing to buy land from the Arabs, to buy Shemitah produce from the Arabs. It's another thing to sell them the land, because there's an iser d'oraisa to sell land to a non-Jew in Eretz Israel. That's called lo sechaneng, do not give them inhabitation. So yes, something a guy already owns doesn't have the laws of Shemitah, but you're not allowed to sell. Right? So that's why, and the third reason why we're against heter mechira is that even if a real sale would be okay, which it isn't anyway, but this is kind of a fake sale because the Jewish owners don't really consider it sold. The chilonim continue to work the land. So these are the three considerations why the Haredi world is against the heter mechira. And again, the Chazon Ish is against it because he simply says selling it to a guy doesn't change anything. That's the Chazon Ish. We actually say selling it to a guy would take off the laws of Shemitah, but our three reasons against the heter mechira is, number one, even if it takes off the holiness from the produce, it does not permit the farming of the land. That's number one. Number two, there's an iser min haTorah to sell land to non-Jews in Eretz Israel. And reason number three is that the Chiloni owners, or the farmers, do not really intend to relinquish ownership, and therefore it's not a mechira and the like. Now, having said that, many, many poskim say that although the chatchila, you should not rely on the heter mechira, you should not buy heter mechira produce, but if you're in somebody's house who otherwise keeps your standard of kashrus, and you get served heter mechira vegetables, and if you would not eat it, it would cause machlokas and the like. So there are many poskim who say b'di'evet, you can eat it. Other people are machmer. You know, again, that's a separate shayla. But Rav Avadya Yosef, of course, his own son is now the chief rabbi who supervises heter mechira, actually also said, he wrote a very long kuntris of over 150-200 pages, where he basically says that although a ben Torah should not be somech on the heter mechira, but you cannot criticize people who do, because there's a great makom in halacha to allow it. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's basically it. But the point that's so fascinating to me is that the most controversial part of Rav Kook's psak is actually the one that is accepted in Yerushalayim, and that is that once you sell something to a guy, the peros don't have the holiness of Shemitah. That is the shita of the minhag of Yerushalayim. Yeah, did you say?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, is there, you know, is it news, an idea used by movies? They're not allowed to watch movies, yeah, but they're not allowed to, but cartoons nowadays, the people also not drawing, not as women.
Oh, cartoons.
Is there any other news by cartoons?
Yeah, I guess you get cartoons, comic books, all sorts of things. Not that you spend time watching cartoons or comic books. Here's the thing. There are two different laws here, but they overlap a lot, but they are two different laws. One law, one halacha, is not to gaze at women. Not to gaze at women, and I don't mean occasionally, you know, looking, but to gaze for the purpose of enjoying their beauty. And that would not apply to a cartoon or a comic book, because that's not an actual picture of a woman. Is even a shaila, does it apply to a photograph there? We will be strict. But there's a separate issue that says a person is not allowed to do anything that gives them sexually improper thoughts. That could even be reading. Let's say you read a pornographic book. You're not looking at anything. But if the verbal descriptions give rise to improper thought, it's not a good thing. So I would say that comics and cartoons fall under the same category as reading sexual literature. So then it would depend. If it doesn't if you feel it doesn't affect you, and you know, who can make that judgment, then it would not be forbidden. If it does affect you, then it would be prohibited. But it would not be technically a drawing is not his tachlis itself. It's only usher because it's called megareh yetzer hara benafshei. You are stirring up the yetzer hara within you. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Regarding dogs, I've heard that Chazal don't say the nicest thing about dogs, and like, what exactly is that I guess regarding dogs and dog ownership?
Well, you know, it's very, very interesting. We have a mixed view about dogs. You know, after all, Chazal basically say that the Torah says for non-kosher meat in the Bela, that you give it to the dogs, because the dogs are being rewarded because at the time of the Makas Becharos, where normally dogs bark when there's like a Malach HaMavas, but the dogs kept quiet, etc., not to disturb the Jewish people eating the Korban Pesach, and because of that they get a certain reward. Like, you know that Pasuk, Uchol B'nei Yisrael Lo Yechres Kalvas Lashono, a dog will not even lap its tongue, you know, back and forth, making a noise. In fact, I was told that they brought down in different form. I never saw it. That if a dog is about to bite you, you recite that pasuk, and the dog is supposed to get paralyzed or whatever it is. I'm not giving you any guarantees for this. So on one hand, dogs are rewarded. The Maharam also says a fascinating thing, which any dog owner would attest, that the reason why a dog is called kelev is kalev. He is attuned to the heart of his master. Like, the dogs instinctively understand human feeling in a very, very great way. Anyway, you know, when you're sad, the dog, you know, knows you're sad and would want to cheer you up and everything else. So now the Gemara in Bava Kamma says, lo yigadel kelev ra b'toich beisai. You should not raise a kelev ra. Now, kelev ra means a vicious dog. And the Gemara says, these are dogs that either bite or dogs that bark a lot. And the reason is because it could scare people. And God forbid, a pregnant woman could even have a miscarriage from it. But the Marshal and other Poskim are medayik that the Isser is only a fierce dog or a barking dog. It does not apply to a dog that's not vicious. And then we have a Shiloh. What if you live in a bad neighborhood? What about a dog for your business? Let's say you have a business, you need a guard dog. All right, that's a Shiloh. But if you're simply talking about a dog that is not vicious, most opinions say it is mutter. Now, there are many, many issues. There are going to be laws of muktzah on Shabbos. There are going to be laws of carrying when there's no eruv. How do you walk a dog? These are halachic Shilohs. And it is very true that in the Torah community, by and large, well, at least in the Haredi yeshiva community, people generally do not own dogs. But part of that is historical. It's very interesting that people have pointed out, at least Ashkenazic Jews, I'm not sure about Sephardim, Ashkenazic Jews tend to be scared of dogs. Even if they like dogs, they're a little scared of dogs. And part of it is that, you know, in the countries, Germany, Poland, dogs were used. Guard dogs were used to attack. And it almost became genetic. We've absorbed into our bloodstream that dogs are scary, mean animals. You'll sometimes see, even in this neighborhood, somebody might have a dog, or somebody might have a dog, and the kids are like so afraid to come up to the dog. And the mother wants them to pet the dog, but the mother's afraid of the dog. You know, it's kind of, you know, what to do? Touch the dog? And the like. So I wouldn't say there's anything bad about it. In fact, I think for children, pets are very, very good. It gives them a certain companionship and it teaches them responsibility. But like anything else, you know, part of it is historical, that dogs were often the sign of people that try, you know, who wanted to destroy us with the dogs. They say the altar of Kelm, Rav Simcha Zissel, who was Rabbi Saul Salanter's greatest Talmud, the altar of Kelm, he was called. His son, who became the Rosh Hashiva of Kelm after Rav Simcha Zissel, he actually owned a dog because owning a dog was what the gentleman did, and he wanted to show you could be a Ben Torah and still kind of be a man of the world. He had a bit of a cheshbon. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but as I say, it is, for different reasons, it is more or less frowned upon, so I don't think, you know, I think people might look a little askance at you I'm not saying how you can decide. I'm not saying no or yes, but that's just a fact of life. Yeah.
The Rob, over the past few weeks, has mentioned a few times the political position of Notori Carter in terms of peacefully dismantling the state and then coexisting with Arabs.
Right.
Without their antics, that really is the position of the Ayla Horeidus, who's like led by Gedolim and people who are very, very intelligent. How so, you know, if tomorrow everyone was to do Shuvah and sort of agree with the Ayla Horeidus, how do we reconcile that really with the reality that we see on the ground with the terrorism and then
Well, you know, I'm not sure. You know, you are 100% correct that in initial viewpoint, the Ayla Horeidus, people that, you know, we rely upon for our stuff, essentially have the exact same opinion as Notori Carter, that the state of Israel was a sin, it should never have been established, and it was, that's why they say it's forbidden to vote in elections. That's the Ayla Horeidus. Now, not the mainstream yeshiva. Well, the mainstream yeshiva world tells people to vote, but the Ayla Horeidus says do not vote in elections. And Brisk, so the Ayla Horeidus is a, Who is the Ayla Horeidus anyway? I mean, it's not so clear. We're not talking about mainstream yeshivas like Mir, Panovich, or Sameach. No, this is not Ayla Horeidus. I mean, you know, we have our disagreements with the secular state, but basically we have members in the Knesset. We participate in elections and the like. So who is Ayla Horeidus? So Ayla Horeidus literally is an umbrella, meaning it has many, many different types of groups. Some are Hasidish and some are not Hasidish. So Satmir is a big faction of the Ayla Horeidus. Ger is not. Ger is Gudas Yisrael, right? Ger Kabbalah Torah, Gudas Yisrael. But Satmir, Toldos Aram, and Notori Carter. Notori Carter actually not Hasidim, but Notori Carter, Satmir, and Toldos Aram, and Brisk. Brisk is the one faction of the, what you might call the mainstream to yeshiva world, to the degree it's mainstream, that Brisk has identified with Notori Carter and the like. Okay, so you have to know your players here. Brisk and Mir, although both of them are great, great yeshivas, very, very different. Mir is not a political yeshiva anyway, but Mir is part of, you know, part of the consortium that says that we work with the state to try to achieve whatever benefits we can for the Torah community. Brisk believes the state is pasul, treif, and it should not exist. However, the difference is the Ayla Horeidus is different than the Notori Carter, because Notori Carter still actively promotes getting rid of the state, such as meeting with Ahmadinejad and the like. The Ayla Horeidus, we would call them as more passive disobedience, meaning they'll put up a sign, don't vote during elections, but the Ayla Horeidus does not do anything active to call for the dismantling of the state of Israel. But the question is, your conclusion is not necessarily the case, meaning it could very well be that within the Ayla Horeidus, although they were against the state of Israel, they recognized that to actively dismantle it now would be a sakana for Jews. So it could very well be that they don't agree with Notori Carter that we should dismantle it now. They feel that it should be a goal, perhaps, but they would not call for dismantling if it is sakana, as opposed to Notori Carter that actually believes, Notori Carter has a theological belief that if we would just get rid of this state, all of the anti-Semitism would disappear, and the Arabs would love us and give them the state of Palestine to do what they want, and we would have all of this tremendous freedom to learn and to daven and to go to the Makomos HaKadoshim. That I'm not sure the Ada believes, because as hateful as the state is to the Ada, I think they think under the Palestinians right now it would be worse. So I think there is Chiluke Deus there. Is Notori Carter even officially part of the Ada Haredes? I'm not sure. I think they may have broken off and just created a separate relatively little splinter group. I don't know. But you know, it's interesting, you walk by sometimes, I'm in Mea Sharim at night sometimes. So I'm walking by and in the Mea Sharim Yeshiva, they're often giving speeches. I think every Thursday night Kamat they give like a speech and it's on a microphone, you can actually hear it, and like harangues against the evil Zionist state. And you see, you see like these little Hasidic kids with payas who are, you know, listening with their eyes wide open. Okay, it's not not the greatest thing, but that is their sheet. Yeah.
I read that the Rishonim, they still had an intact Masorah, and that they were basically using the Gemara to check their Masorah, and whereas the Acharonim, they for whatever reason didn't have a Masorah, so now they're more on our side, kind of learning the Gemara to get the Halacha. So, kind of, I guess my question is, seems like strange, first of all, maybe what happened in between the two time periods.
Right? Well, yeah, it's a very good nakuda. Let me give you at least in a general sense an example of what you're talking about. Sometimes, you know, you have a Gemara, and Tosfos, because of a bunch of kashas, let's say Rebbeinu Tam or the Ri, will learn the Gemara in a very ingenious way, but putting so many things into the Gemara that aren't in the words of the Gemara. Oh, the Gemara is talking about this particular case. And if you read the Gemara, you know, in a million years, you would not figure out that the Gemara is talking about this case. Like, why didn't it say this case? So one of the Mahalchim is that the Rishonim were not only working with pure logic, they also had a Masorah. They had certain traditions handed down as to what the text meant, and therefore they were able to read it into the text because they had the Masorah, as opposed to Acharonim, who don't have that same Masorah, so all they have is their logic and their learning like we have, and therefore they have to base it on what it says. They can't put in things that aren't there. And there is such a concept that the Rishonim were still Bali Masorah, but so how did it end? Well, basically it started off like this. Right after the Chasima of the Gemara, the leadership of Am Yisrael was very, very centralized. The Gaonim of Babel, there were two yeshivas in Babel, Sura and Pumbedisa. And at different times, one was more dominant, the other was more dominant, etc. Rav Haigain was Pumbedisa, Rav Sajagon was Sura, and they went back and forth, but these were the two yeshivas. And that was a situation where the Torah leadership of the whole world was focused in one place. That happened to be the place where the Gemara itself was written. And therefore they had Masorahs. The Gaonim very, very definitely had Masorahs. The Ramban will often say, when the Ramban sees certain Rishonim saying things against the Gaonim, the Ramban would say, how could you go against the Gaonim? They are the Balei Masorah of what the Gemara means. I don't mean necessarily, when I say Masorah, I'm not talking about Halacha Moshe Misina, I'm just talking about something less. I'm saying a Masorah as to what Ravina and Ravashi meant when they wrote the Gemara. So what happened basically was, like everything else, as the Jewish communities became more dispersed, you had Jews in Spain, in France, in Germany, in Poland, in Russia, they were spread out. It was much more difficult to communicate. People no longer had accurate traditions of what things were. People had different versions, people had misunderstandings. So, in fact, even in the later Rishonim, you have this. This idea that all the Rishonim were Bali Masorah, I think, is not entirely true. It may refer to the earlier Rishonim, even before Rashi, Rabbeinu Hanano, Rabbeinu Gershom, the very, very earliest Rishonim were still acting by Bali Masorah. By the time you get to Rashi and Tosfos already, then you may not have an unbroken Masorah at this point. Rashi may have been one of the last, because Rashi sometimes does record Masorahs from the Gaonim that he had. But like anything else, the same thing that happened to the Torah Shebaal Peh, why it had to be written down, happened to this idea as well. Okay? Okay, going once, going twice. Yeah?
The rabbi, I believe it was Rosh Hashanah, the one with the smooth in that.
Yeah.
We're speaking about when the tables were broken, it shed darkness upon the Torah, upon light, and had the tablets not been broken, then there would have been darkness, and there would have been confusion between among people about which the right interpretation for the Torah is. The question that I had was: is this could be mashma that a person may not have to work as hard to get shot on the Torah? Is that the case? And if it is, then how is that a person can acquire it? That was the case, the Torah, the Torah.
Yeah, that's a very, very excellent kasha. And the MS is this seems to be based on a Yerushalmi. It's not just, I was saying something from Rav Tzadok, but it is ultimately a Yerushalmi that says that on the first Luchais, everything would have been explicit. In other words, we would have known all of the halachas, as opposed to the second Luchas, where we just have the written Torah, and then we need the oral Torah, and then we have to figure things out with logic and svara, and we forget. The Luchas Rishinus, everything was explicit. Somehow you would look at, it would tell you the law for cloning and genetic engineering and nuclear war. Everything would have been beferish. There would have been clarity. There wouldn't have been machlokas. There wouldn't have been shichacha. There wouldn't have been a concept of a Torah Shebal Peh, because everything would have been in writing. We don't know how huge that would have been. And the whole idea of having to work is the Gezerah, just as Adam was cursed, that he has to generate his bread by the sweat of his brow, so too that was a punishment, so to speak, that Torah is nikness only with working and yegia. So the question that you're asking is a very good question. That implies that the imperative of working for Torah is a punishment or a consequence of the cheta egel that resulted in the breaking of the luchais. And that would have implied that in the ideal world, we would get Torah without amelus. But that seems to contradict what we always believe, we always say, that the ikar purpose of a person's life is amelus for Torah. Right? Now, you can ask a similar question. I'll just give you a similar question. With Adam HaRishon, we say that eating from the Eitz Hadas gave Adam HaRishon the struggle between good and evil. And we have to struggle only because of the chayt of the Eitz Hadas, which means had there not been the chayt of the Eitz Hadas, we wouldn't have had to struggle. But then the question I would ask you is, what would the purpose of our life have been? We say, the purpose of our life is to struggle against the Eitz Hara. But if you're telling me, had there not been a chayt, we wouldn't have that purpose, what would our purpose have? It's an exactly symmetrical question, meaning to say, what would the purpose have been? So all I could say is this, all I could say is, as perhaps B'derech Efsher. Actually, I'm not answering the other more recent question. I'm asking your question directly. That Amelus B'Torah always exists on infinite levels, meaning the way it is now, we have to be Amel to know the Halacha. And as a result, we're unclear and confused. But let's say we always knew the Halacha, but there's still going to be infinite delving into the logic and the meaning and the depth. So instead of an amelus b'tayra in which we're groping for confusion in terms of what the din is, that would have been clear, but the amelus would have proceeded on the level after that. Meaning, there still would have been amelus, but it would have been at higher and higher levels. Now, that could be an answer for the Adam HaRishon as well. Meaning, even if we hadn't eaten from the Eitz Hadas, there still would have been bechira, but it wouldn't have been bechira between good and evil. It would have been bechira and the different levels of good that could exist in life. Good and better, as opposed to good and evil. Right? So that would be the teretz for this. And this is an important idea. Amelus b'tayra can exist on all levels. I mean, let's go back to something that is a little controversial, right? Obviously, in our yeshiva, really, in all yeshivas, we don't like you to use art scroll. Right? Don't use art scroll. Not allowed to use an art scroll tomorrow. Okay? If we see an art scroll tomorrow, we will confiscate it. So the question is, people, and the reason that's given sometimes, well, the practical reason is that if you're overly dependent on a crutch, you'll never learn to navigate yourself, and you want to learn how to learn Gemara by yourself, so you need to separate yourself from the crutch. Okay, but once in a while you'll get a firmer reason, and the firmer reason is the purpose of Limud HaTorah is Amelus BaTorah. So when you have shortcuts, you are negating Amelus B'Torah, and that's a bad thing. So Lani Estaiti, that's not a good reason, actually. Because it's true that if you were to content yourself with the translation, so you would be short-circuiting the Amelus B'Torah, and that's a wrong thing. But if you look at it another way, I'm still going to put in my 3 or 4 hours to understand this Gemara. But instead of spending 3.5 hours looking at a Jastrow, I will get the translation after a half an hour, and I will spend the other 3 hours thinking about what I'm learning and trying to understand it. You haven't eliminated Amelus B'Torah. You've simply taken your Amelus B'Torah from a lower level and you moved it to a higher level. And that's perfectly fine. In fact, one could argue that's even better, because this way I'm putting the kochos of my amelus as something that's a more advanced level. So the first reason is a good reason. You know, we don't want you to get over dependent on a crutch. But the idea that somehow you're circumventing amelus would be true if you would stop at the superficial. But it doesn't have to be true if you use it as a springboard for greater Ian. So I'm saying the same thing with the Luchos Rishonos and Luchos Shenios. Now, we have to be Amel just to know what to do. That Hashem would have given us, and then our Amelus would be on that higher Madrega. Okay, have a good day. See you.